So you're my eyeball witness, huh? So why'd you step up on this? Bird trifling, basically. Killing every day working man and all. I mean, I do some dirt too, but I ain't never put my gun on nobody that wasn't in the game. A man must have... Oh, no doubt. Hello and welcome to Distorted Shades of Grey, where a Scottish Jew and a Nigerian Kiwi do things for the culture, so you don't have to. On this podcast, we're talking Jordan Peele's debut movie, Get Out, what we thought of the movie, the reaction to the movie, and what it was like watching it in our very different shoes. We also talk about this month in hip-hop. We talk Stormzy, we talk Future, we talk Drake, we talk Taylor Bennett, and we talk about the direction that hip-hop's going. And sadly, we will finish off with a absolutely sensational interview by President Donald, and I still can't believe that I'm getting used to calling him President, Donald Trump, that he gave with Time Magazine. Without further ado, I'm Kalichio Sunwa, and I'm a Nigerian Kiwi.
And I'm Mark Stern, and I'm the Scottish Jew. I liked how you said further ado there. It worked as the segue was going strong. We've got this podcast thing down, and we're only 2 minutes in.
That whole adieu line was one that got like shoved in my face once when I said, gentlemen, I bid you all adieu, and my person in one of the teams said, dude, I'm a Jew, you know that, right? And I was like, oh, good God, so sorry. Wait a minute. I didn't mean anything offensive, but
yeah,
thanks for bringing that up and reminded me
of that. I just think it's going to be far harder to work Igbo or Nigerian into some sort of backhanded insult like that.
Oh. all right, so this is our first podcast of Distorted Shades of Grey. And I suppose the easiest thing for us to do is basically speak about why we're doing it for episode one and go from there. So, Mark.
Mate, how's it going? So, yeah, I mean, we did a podcast a few weeks ago and I really enjoyed it. I sent you an email basically being like, look, I've got this crazy idea. Why don't we put the band back together and do this every week? You know, I really enjoy talking to you, obviously, personally, but also, you know, keep it quiet, but trying to get my way into journalism through writing and podcasting. And I used to do radio when I was a student and, you know, talking online about, you know, culture, music, movies, and how they become representations of everything interesting in the world. And just piques my curiosity all the time. So I just really wanted to have a weekly slot and phone you up and talk to you from the greyness of London to the greyness of Manchester.
Well, Manchester's not very grey right now, mate. Sunshine, people are outside in 12 degree temperatures with t-shirts on, so...
What have you been doing up there?
Yeah, we've been outside, but we're back inside. And look, it's great that you said that, because I suppose that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this as well. Last year, I challenged myself to produce one piece of media every month, whether it was a piece of writing or podcast, and successfully did that. And this year I just feel like it's an absolutely natural step to take in terms of moving forward and doing something weekly. I also feel that I think we probably complement each other, not only in where we've been raised in our points of view, but also like I don't necessarily know that much about music, so it's sensational to sit here and learn more and listen more and think about where the intersections lie as well. So let's get started with Get Out. So I've almost finished writing a piece on Get Out and how I thought about the movie, or what I thought about the movie, and how I thought that what Peele did in a very ingenious way was, and he says this himself, he says he wanted to make sure people spoke about race. And what I thought in a very ingenious way was he made statements and he made points of view that not only black people can take, not only white people can take, because I think all the reviews have been about white liberalism and how the movie is a massive slap in the face of that, and how the movie earmarks slavery, and other people have taken it as a massive call for reverse racism. And I read one interesting article about, you know, how it propagated the Asian American in that scene as the modern migrant who was asking the very uncomfortable question. But I didn't necessarily see a lot of things about how Peele actually, in his own way, spoke towards the black community as well. And I think what people forget is Peele, in his own right and as a person, is married to a white woman, like a very rich and successful white woman. And he would have seen some prejudice coming from both sense of community. So my piece is around that. But I wanted to get your thoughts on what you thought the movie, what you thought about the movie, how you felt. I remember you pulled out some really, really interesting points. By the way, there's going to be a lot of spoiler alerts in this. So if you haven't seen the movie, maybe fast forward like 15 minutes. What you thought, because the first two points you made was one that I noticed where it was the music, but the second one I didn't notice, which was the lynching scene right at the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the opening scene was so important in terms of setting people's expectation was what was to follow. You know, in horror movies, the monster is obviously the key, and it's the key not only in driving forward the narrative, but also for us in understanding, you know, in quotation marks, the goodies v. the baddies. You know, what are the good aspects, the bad aspects, and what do they represent about our culture? But I think that first scene was so great because when I think it brings up this point, which, you know, I think lots of white people will feel walking through, you know, dodgy suburbs in London or in New York, or, you know, dodgy again, quotation marks, where they feel like they're under threat just because of the physical location they are in, that feeling isn't afforded to people that would traditionally be occupying those dodgy, in quotation mark, boroughs. And it really turned that on its head in a way that was really interesting and kind of revelatory, at least for me, to kind of have that expansion of empathy, I guess. But then also, you know, on your screen, what is essentially happening is a lynching. That's the only thing that I can kind of come to. Like, it's very much reminiscent of, or at least alluding to, this dark history in the States where, you know, however many hundreds or thousands of people were killed just because of their skin color. And I think, you know, those have been done before. Lynching scenes in movies, especially quite recently, it's obviously like 12 Years a Slave and The Birth of a Nation, that, you know, the most recent Birth of a Nation being two prominent examples whereby the kind of traditional African-American experience is painted on screen as, you know, slaves and how they try and, you know, fight for freedom or fail at freedom. And what I kind of said to you was, it made me think that what was so amazing about the scene is you're managing to talk about this same history that is there in 12 Years a Slave, but the movie isn't being slotted into a genre that just will immediately change people's perceptions of the movie. You know, 12 Years a Slave was a movie about slavery with a capital S. It was a movie about the struggle, and it was a movie about, you know, how terrible things were in America's past, and all of those things are true. But I think, especially from family and friends who heard about the movie but didn't go and see about the movie, because, oh my god, how could you possibly go and sit and watch a movie like that for
an hour and a half?
Yeah. You know, it's like going and watching a movie about the Holocaust or something. And so this is where I get this idea that, you know, there's a kind of almost genre ghettoization whereby the Black experience can only be shown in certain ways, and slavery and the slave trade and the Atlantic crossing, and that's one where it's very limited to. I'm not saying that those movies are important, because obviously they're fundamentally important, but my long way around saying is Get Out in the first 3 minutes has managed to cover all of that ground in a way that still leaves people's minds open and receptive to everything else that follows. So it's like confrontational in the least confrontational way, which I thought was so well done.
I'm going to admit I completely missed that kind of reversal on its head, where it's I'm not walking where the dodgy street is suburbia. You know what I mean? I completely like didn't connect that where the dodgy street is suburbia. And maybe it's because I've lived in Moss Side, and like walking through Moss Side, I was there. It's Moss Side, like it's fine, just don't walk through that park at night. But any moron wouldn't walk through that park at night. It's dimly lit kind of thing. But yeah, that really was an interesting bit where he completely flipped it on its head and showed it in one kind of setting. And I think it's a masterpiece, because there are moments like that that happen all the time. There's there's the very clear and overt references, and there's the kind of subtle ones like that. And you know, the clear and overt references, for example, where they literally bid on him while playing bingo, as if it was your everyday normal activity, which it absolutely was back in the day. You know, people would literally go out there, bid for another human being, take postcards, take photos, and go back. The scene where the lady's feeling up his muscles and arms, again, something you would completely do to a slave, where you're sitting there going, oh, is this person going to be able to, like, put in the work that I need him to do? Now, she was hoping he put in work in a completely different way, but it was still putting in that work. But yeah, I keep thinking about the movie, and I keep thinking about how he kind of forces that conversation to be had. And again, from my experience, you know, what was your experience like watching it in the movie theater? Tell us, just going in there, sitting down, watching it. What was it like?
Oh, you know, it was excellent. I mean, the theater was absolutely packed. And interestingly, sitting beside me in the theater was a mixed race couple. And I was just wondering, I was like, what must it be like to, like, you know, have that shared experience and talk about it? Because obviously I have no access into what that dynamic must be like. I mean, I'm sure you'll have lots more to say about that than me. But I think it's the first time in maybe ever that in that final scene where the cop car turns up, like, and his mate is the one that steps out of the cop car. Like,
Hall of Famer.
A round of applause, like, went through the whole theatre. Like, it was the first time that that's ever happened, maybe apart from going to, you know, film festivals where that stuff happens regularly at the end of the movie. But this was like, the movie is still playing, but everyone's like whooping and hollering and like clapping their hands. Because
just for context, you watch it in Brixton, right?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. That's why.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, no, I mean, what I wanted to go back to what you said about it, because I feel like we're bringing up things that, you know, each of us hadn't thought about, because I'm directly like that to the slave trade in the sense of people's worth being their physicality. But I wondered, you know, when that scene was happening, it reminded me, you know, very strongly of this kind of Paul Beattie-esque approach whereby black people are held up as these, like, you know, it's almost a fetishization of their, you know, physique and, you know, strength, speed, ability, but then held at complete arm's distance over pretty much everything else. And I wondered if that was something that, you know, you had ever felt has touched you directly.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it, I've noticed it before. I remember one teacher at school was just like, we were talking about like having children and stuff like that. And she was, oh, people would love to have kids with you, Kalichi. I mean, look at you, you're big, you're strong, you're fast. And I was like, okay. Like, I mean, those are reasons that, you know, any woman would want to have children with me, because I'm big, I'm strong, and I'm fast. And this was in high school. And again, like, there was no malice intended. I didn't even realize it until years later that I was like, that wasn't necessarily a compliment, young man. Like, yeah. And it's interesting that you had a round of applause, because, like, I watched it in East Didsbury. I watched it twice, right? I watched it the first time with my girlfriend, and my girlfriend's white. And, like, I could feel the stairs as me and her walked up. And, like, the stairs, in a very ironic and funny way to the movie, came from, like, two rows of black women. And so, like, I could feel all of their eyes. She was completely oblivious to it. Again, in a very ironic way to, like, the movie in itself, right? Where, like, she's completely oblivious to it, and I can feel all of their eyes on me. And then when that scene happens, when Chris goes, yeah, look, it's a thing. They don't like, you know, it's a thing. And his girlfriend kind of, like, plays it down and says, girls are so jealous of you that they are turning off your phones. Like, that's actually not necessarily just like that, but, like, people have a very, like, uncomfortable with interracial relationships. And I speak about how Serena Williams had to give reasons why she's married to a white guy. I speak about how the actor playing Luke Cage had to basically justify why he's married to a white woman. I speak about how Common, the rapper, one of my favorite rappers, had to backtrack from his rap lyric, which was black men walking with white girls on their arms, I'd be mad at them as if I was their moms. Black men walking with white girls on their arms, I'd be mad as if I know their moms. Told to go. Because earlier last year he was dating a white British woman. And so it's like these feelings are prevalent. They're not necessarily just in like white people, but also in black people. And it was interesting how that movie makes that fear, makes that feeling of unfamiliarity very present and very well known. You know, where Chris's best friend, Rod, is basically saying, I told you not to go to a white woman's house. And the reason clearly isn't because he's racist. Maybe it is, but it's also just this kind of sense of unfamiliarity. And in a very funny way, it kind of made a mockery of how Samuel L. Jackson tried to like monopolize that feeling as only a black American feeling, when it could be the same feeling for a Jew and a Gentile. It could be the same feeling for a Protestant and a Catholic. It could be that same, I've had the same feeling dating a Nigerian woman, but from a different tribe. And so that feeling of unfamiliarity, which causes division, which causes a bit of distrust, is quite interesting. And just going back to the like that fetishization of the hyper over sexualized black man, it's funny because Peele plays both. He plays that role of Chris being fetishized for his like ability and being told that with his genetic makeup he could be a beast, and how the guy with no eyes wants to like monopolize his talent and his view. But at the same time, Rose his character is completely played out and hypersexualized. They weren't necessarily hypersexualized, but it's hyper thought of in the way of she's that like fine like blonde girl who plays on the police, who has the absolute power to on one hand call the police out for their bullshit racism, but at the same time be able to like bat her eyelids and be protected by the police. He juxtaposes all these stereotypes that are completely played out with both, and I think it's brilliant because in his conversations he has with the ringer, he says, I just want everybody to talk about race and to talk about race better. And I think the critical thought and dialogue that will come out from this, I think it's kind of been misplaced, but I do like that a lot of people are sitting here speaking more about the movie, speaking more about themes that are coming through as well.
Yeah, no, that's really true. I've seen interviews with Jordan Peele talking about, I just want to say as well, like the movie is so well made that he clearly has a fantastic understanding of the horror genre. Mm. Like his fandom of horror really, really does come through. And I think I've heard an interview with him, I think it was on Fresh Air, and he was talking about that feeling in horror movies where you get access to the main character and the kind of first third is, you know, creepy and creepier things are starting to happen, but they're the only one that know about it and there's no one else to verify, or at least no one else to believe that these creepy things are happening. Mm-hmm. And he said on this interview, he was like, you know, this movie is like replacing the creepiness with racism, and how weird it is to live in a country where you're told all the time that racism doesn't exist, but you continually experience it through all of these, you know, either micro or like microaggressions or, you know, serious aggressions against your person just because you're not white. And I thought that was like, you know, a perfect summation of what that whole movie is doing, is just this, you know, taking viewers through it, being like, you know, you, because you're watching this being like, oh my God, something's wrong, like get out.
Yeah.
Like literally just get out. But to be able to have that thought, you have to be, you know, processing the fact that all of this is happening because the main character is black. And that's what it's like kind of getting you to think about in everyday life. And I feel like, I mean, I'd like to think if you went in there kind of in this, having an idea that we were in a post-racial world, that it would really make you think about things from a different perspective. specifically to do with that idea that, you know, if you've ever been the one sitting there being like, no, I don't actually think that is racist, or maybe you're just being a bit sensitive about that, then it really turns that on its head. So, I mean, I think as a horror movie, it was perfect, and it had some fantastic social commentary alongside it. But, you know, if it had done the social commentary too much, it wouldn't have made it as good a horror movie. So I think that's what's... it makes it such a good movie, is the fact that it does both.
I think, like, I think I've come into that movie and seen it once. I kind of... again, maybe it's because I'm now, like, dating someone who's white, and I'm realizing that a lot of pointed views and point of, like, pointed looks that come into our direction also come from people of color. And I suppose I'm a little bit more critical on that regard, where I'm just like, well, people of color should, like, know this. And there's a really cool line where Chris makes, where he's just like, it's as if they missed the movement. And it's this idea that, like, hold on, like, things have happened. We need to actually get on board with the movement in terms of moving forward, and we can't necessarily hold aggressive views in our community. And one of the things that I found really eye-opening for me, because I'm sitting here trying to write this piece, going back through every contentious bit and be like, well, this is why it's contentious, or this is why it isn't contentious, or this is why I think it should be thought of more. And one of the bits that struck me with, like, the last one, that's 5 minutes that we have here, is the bit where the old guy comes in and he's a golfer. And he's like, yeah, I played golf professionally for a long time. And his wife kind of stitches him up and is like, he knows Tiger. And it's like, it's a cringeworthy scene, but at the same time, he one didn't say anything about knowing Tiger. He too kind of looked at it as like this bit of familiarity that he had, because one, probably black people aren't in his sphere and in his circle, but also because, like, knowing Tiger was a dope thing. And it made me think about, I might have done this with yourself, where it's, oh, you're from Scotland. Do you know Loch Lomond? Have you heard this song? What do you think of William Wallace? Or what do you think of Walter Scott? And it's trying to show this sort of, like, familiarity, or trying to be like, hey, man, like, I'm kind of interested in your culture, interested in who you are, or I've heard, or I'm giving you everything I know about Scotland. Or in the classic case, it'd be like, oh, who do you support? Celtic Rangers.
Yeah.
As if every Scottish person is into football. So it had me, like, questioning things even to that extent, to a certain beat as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I think there's distinct differences. I mean, this conversation reminds me of, you know, but where are you from? I don't know. You must get that here. I don't know. Maybe you don't, but it's never really happened to me. But I can tell from, you know, things that I've read, shows that I've watched, that especially when I lived in Canada, on the West Coast in Canada, you know, interestingly, Chinese people arrived in Canada at the same time as British and French people, but no one really remembers that. So, like, Chinese Canadians are a massive part of the Vancouver population. And, you know, I think less so in Vancouver, but I think when you travel outside of the country in Canada, there's a lot of, but where are you from? You know, you're not Canadian. You know, those people are like second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth generation Canadian. And I think it comes close to that conversation, where I can get that lots of people are just interested and want to make a connection and feel like they have that bond. But I don't know. It just doesn't... there is something challenging about it that isn't just pure curiosity that leads people to have that conversation. I think it is based in replicating a, you know, Orientalism that maybe, you know, puts you as the person who's saying that in a position whereby you're being othered. And I don't think that's really the case for Scottish people, because, you know, if you're Scottish, you essentially are the embodiment of, you know, white, middle-class, bourgeois, empowered, you know, central, patriarchal, you know, whatever word it is you want to use. There's a power imbalance. It doesn't really exist to Scottish people.
I get that, and I suppose my commentary there is like, and again, that this even shows in the presentation that it happens in, right? Because after that scene happens, he gets touched up by the lady who's measuring his arm and asking his girlfriend, is it true? And then the next scene is just like, well, look, you know, for the last 100 years or so, white has been in favor. Now black is in. And it's like, not bad, bad and terrible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so it had me thinking of people who would completely just jump the gun and be like, that's so racist, you're so racist. And it's like, yeah, man, I don't know, man. Like that guy is not necessarily, well, he's not telling me that it's great right now to be white or great right now to be black. And look, I'd rather be black right now than in like 1770, for example, right? But it's sitting there being like, okay, look, let's have more critical thought, understanding. We're going to place this as opposed to placing it with the woman grabbing my bicep and telling me that I'm built for sex and hopefully it's as good as they say it is. But yeah, I think what we've just done is basically what Peel wanted in its own kind of way, is sitting here having these conversations and pointing out what we think of race and how we think race works and how these dynamics work out. And hopefully the piece will get done pretty soon and we can actually have a bit more read of it and flesh out my thoughts that way as well.
Yeah, definitely. I'm really looking forward to reading it.
All right. We'll use that to end part one. In part two, we'll be back doing more stuff for the culture.
What are we talking about here? Mighty Most Def. It's simple mathematics. Check it out.
I'll revolve around science. What are we talking about? Hello and welcome back to Distorted Shades of Grey. You're here with Mark Stern and Kalechi Osunwa. And for part, is that about Chinamerum? Chinamerum Osunwa?
Kalechi Chinamerum Osunwa. Kalechi's fine.
Just Kalechi. So part two, we're here to talk about the month that was in hip hop. So we had a bit of a email back and forth about two or three different things that all seemed to be regarding hip-hop artists. So we felt like, well, I felt like I'll just kind of smash these all together. And I think there is a central point running through them, although it might take me a while to get there. But essentially, in chronology, since February 17th, Future drops two albums, Hendrix and Future, both back-to-back, which is strange and nobody really expected. Stormzy, Gang Signs and Prayers, February 24th. On the same day, Taylor Bennett, Chance the Rapper's brother, Restoration of American Idol drops. And then, was it last week? The week before, Drake publishes More Views. And I just think there's something interesting running through these four or five really successful albums. And I'm really interested to hear your thoughts, Kalechi. I'm interested to hear anybody that wishes to listen, send us email or tweet or get in touch. But I think, you know, chronologically you start and you look at somebody like Future, and I think 10 years ago, 15 years ago, coming out of Atlanta, Outkast signed this really talented rapper and promote him, and it's now been, I think that this is his fifth and sixth proper, fully recorded, promoted album. And I wondered if possibly it's a slightly regressive album. And that was how I approached it. But I know you've got different thoughts on this, so I'd be interested to hear your kind of breakdown of the album. Because for me, in the four that I just mentioned, Future really seems to be doing his thing, but that thing maybe isn't the most exciting art to be being made in the hip-hop community right now. And I would just appreciate if you wanted to argue back with that, or if that's something you would agree with.
Future's a weird one, and I'm not going to lie. I've probably started listening to Future as much this year, right? Like, I refused to listen to him last year. I just thought he was a mumble rapper, and then the more I've listened, I've kind of realized that there is a lot of depth to what he is saying, but there's also a lot of big beats and kind of like little tiny drops or little tiny funny lines that come in there. And I kind of think he's like a modern day Rick Ross in his own kind of way, right? And Rick Ross,
right,
has the great ad lib. He's got this incredible eye for beats. His like rapping style is slow and it's simple, and it's nothing like his rapping style was when he did like Hustling, right? And so like you think about his song like Blowing Money Fair, it's like, I think I'm Big Meech, Larry Hoover, whipping work, hallelujah. I think I'm Big Meech, Larry Hoover, whipping work, hallelujah. like Future's kind of like sped up and just a bit more impactful. The funny thing is that I don't necessarily think he's that great a rapper. I don't think he's a rapper in the scale of, for example, Killer Mike.
Yeah.
Like, Killer Mike is a rapper. Like, yeah. Killer Mike was born to rap kind of thing.
Yeah.
And Future feels like this kind of intertwine in... You probably call him an artist in the same way people call Drake an artist, right? Not necessarily a rapper in the same way people call J. Cole or Kendrick Lamar rappers. And so, I feel he's in this place where you kind of wonder where he's going. But like you're saying, and like I've been looking at now, his Spotify has him dropping albums since like 2011, man. So he's not going away anytime soon, right?
We're going to have to deal with him.
Yeah, like we're going to have to deal with it. And like we're going to have to appreciate it because, I mean, I listen to Mask Off almost every second day now.
Mask on. Fuck it, mask on. Mask on, fuck it, mask on, mask on. Percocet, Miley Percocet, chase the chick.
Yeah, yeah, that's really interesting. And I think why I bring Future up is I read an unconfirmed report that he had previously come up with a friend on this friend's record label, and this friend is meant to be pivotal in Future's breaking into the industry, kind of teaching him the ropes, getting him up and running on his own record label, not Future's, the friend's. And there had been reports of a schism. Future signed a record deal with a major label and then got sued by this friend, I assume ex-friend, I don't know if there's still what's happening in communication, but whatever. And this ended up in, apparently, Future being required to publish two further albums to close off his contract with his old friend's record label. And I guess even if it's not true, it exposes a side to the industry that is pure kind of economics and business that is driving this forward. And I don't mean that to necessarily comment on the art that was made, but it just really kind of powerfully reminds me of point that Questlove made in an essay for Vulture back in 2014. And this was on how hip-hop failed the black community. And I think I'm just going to read the quote and then I can continue on afterwards about why I think this links in the Future. And as context, he's talking about Run DMC really brought to the fore the commercial aspects of hip hop in a way that being able to pay for your own Adidas's was a sign of your, you know, being able to own something was a sign of your freedom in a way that, you know, black people, black African American bodies never previously had. But that's moved down the continuum now to a point whereby Jay-Z can rap about having a Maybach or a Bugatti.
luxury rap has taken over.
To the point where Jay-Z ends up, you know, I think in one of his music videos, like, blows up a Maybach as some symbol of how wealthy he is, you know, or they talk about their massive watches or whatever. So this is the quote. But what does it mean that hearing the song somehow makes me measure myself against its outsized boasting? For starters, it means that hip-hop has become complicit in the process by which winners are increasingly isolated from the populations they are supposed to inspire and engage, which are also, in theory, the populations that are supposed to furnish the next crop of winners. This isn't a black thing or even a hip-hop thing exclusively. American politics functions the same way, but it's a significant turnaround and come-down for a music that was, only a little while back, devoted to reflecting the experience of real people and through that reflection, challenging the power structures that produces inequality and disenfranchisement. Now, I mean, Future there, where does he sit on that? If you use what Questlove just outlined very articulately there as a kind of question to apply to these recent rap albums, Future, to me, feels like he is complicit in that process in a way that isn't very comfortable and in a way that he probably didn't arrive on the scene being complicit in.
I think he's more complicit than not. Like, I think, again, like with that classic case of hip-hop and music is reflection of self and reflection of surroundings. I think he, in one respect, speaks about his surroundings, but the other respect, he completely... I think he takes to another level, man. Like, the if he's addicted to promethazine and scissor, like... You'd think he'd want to be addicted to promethazine, right? Like, you'd think he'd want to be, like, addicted to it. And, yeah, at the same time, I also think about Kanye West, and that paragraph made me think of Kanye West in terms of, like, missing the old Kanye, missing the Kanye West who gets up on stage and is like, George doesn't care about black people, as opposed to the Kanye West who last year was like, yeah, well, black people, you need to stop talking about racism all the time because racism is over. And it's like, yeah. Well, like, what?
Yeah, let's not bring Kanye into this. That's just a whole podcast all on its own right there.
But it's interesting to sit there and see where these lines get drawn, right? Because, like, you think about that and you juxtapose it with the album from Stormzy, Gang Signs and Prayers. You juxtapose that with Taylor Bennett's album. You even juxtapose that with Formation, right? And the powerful statements that have come there, and even, like, to a certain extent, some of the songs from Jay-Z's last album, Holy Grail, right, where he speaks about slave ships and he speaks about the awfulness of kind of been addicted to rap, because he sits there and he says, this is a life that I have dreamed for, and if you told a kid from Marcy you could have this life, you'd be like, what? And all you have to worry about is dropping albums and people stalking you and your daughter around. What the hell is wrong with you? Told my window, this fame hurts, this chain works. I think back, person, if this is all you have to deal with, nigga, deal with this shit. This ain't work, this light work. Camera snapping, my eyes hurt. Niggas dying back where I was birthed. Fuck your iris and the IRS. You take that life every day. So it's interesting to sit there and look at it from both sides and think, is he actually doing anything productive for the culture? I suppose the, like, the Bomani Jones in me says, why is it his responsibility?
Well, totally. That's so true. And you give it a weight to carry that, why does it have to?
Yeah.
I totally get that. But I just think, I mean, the examples that you gave, and we can, you know, move this on from future at this point, is that something like Gang Signs and Prayers is almost built around the thesis that Questlove puts forward in that quote, in terms of its acknowledged responsibility to family, both blood family and cultural family, to his community, to, you know, Stormzy growing up in Croydon, South London, and seeing the clear, you know, disenfranchisement, as Questlove calls it, of the people that he went to school with, of the people that he was friends with, in a way that the British state has not, and I guess will never be there for people like that, in a way that is the basis of inequality in the United Kingdom. And he went out and wrote a movie about that, and not only about that, you know, those big macro issues, but also the deeply personal aspects of his own relationship to depression, and how difficult it is to talk about that in the context of the hip hop community that's traditionally, you know, the braggadocio and the overt masculinity. Dark times, niggas die in a recession. You was fighting with your girl, and I was fighting my depression. Wait. Okay. And I think, again, this is where it gets quite neat for me, is like Taylor Bennett is, you know, I think in January came out as bisexual, and, you know, you've got this whole different conversation in the way that you've got people. I mean, I think Stormzy's like 23, dude, and he's like driving on the music industry in a way that, you know, other people, at least in the UK, are not. And yeah. I think, you know, when you start it, I guess what we're talking about here is the failure of genres to be very descriptive, because in the same genres you have Future, and I guess somebody like Drake, not for his kind of artistic ability or temperament, but more just kind of, he'll release a new playlist of 24 songs and there might be a few decent songs on there, but at the end of the day, he can go on tour again and charge 110 quid for the cheapest tickets at the O2 and sell that out for 7 nights. I've not done the maths, but I assume that makes him a pretty penny.
It's them checks.
And you've got them in the same, you know, category or genre as Stormzy or as Taylor Bennett, and I feel like, you know, if you consider them all together, Stormzy and Taylor Bennett are very much in the ascendancy in terms of not only their career, but also the success that they're being able to finding new audiences, selling records, and, you know, standing alongside people like Jordan Peele from our first segment and challenging our ideas of identity and experience through music.
And that's what's interesting, right? Like, the on one hand, Future is popular because there is a demand for something like that, right? There is a demand to have people switch off. There is a demand to not necessarily listen to conscious rap all the time, right? But at the same time, and it's interesting seeing how much something like Stormzy is being appreciated, something like Taylor Bennett is being appreciated. And it's interesting even adding that to the same level as Drake, who was the quintessential emotional rapper, especially when you put that in there with Kid Cudi, a major success on his first album. Again, this kind of emotional, putting his feelings on the line, questioning masculinity, questioning the tropes that have been around, what it's like to be this kind of hip-hop artist, so to speak. So it's interesting seeing that Stormzy comes out. I remember listening to Stormzy's album and first thinking, this isn't as aggressive enough as I wanted it. I wanted to hear more Shut Up. I wanted to hear more Stormzy's this, Stormzy's that, Stormzy's blick, Stormzy's black. I wanted to hear more of that.
Michael, big storms. I like paintings. I like porn. I got a six porn. I breathe fire every time I yawn. Stormzy's this, Stormzy's that, Stormzy's blick, Stormzy's black, Stormzy's hairlines go way back. But I still fuck your girl. Go and retweet that little nigga, yo. Man, I saying that.
And then sitting there and actually listening to him do an ode to his mum with 100 bags, right? And have interludes of his mum praying for him, like that showed a different side of the aggression, a different side of the vulnerability, a different side of his experience. And it's great to see rappers coming out there and showing more sensitive side of their experiences, but also seeing that it sells and seeing that it's popular. And it'd be interesting to see how that actually moves forward going along. And we've got Kendrick Lamar, who's apparently dropping a new album next month.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's talking about how, like, he's mentioned the fourth, and so all signs are pointing to it being like the fourth month. But also Joey Badass is dropping an album, and it's apparently like very political as well. And to see how it's been received, whether there is still that scope for people to get political and get mainstream and not necessarily stay with Future. And look, like I don't understand half of the words Future is saying, but sometimes man, like, you want to just run and you like Percocet, Marley Percocet, like you just get into this like dumb zone where you like the amount of times where I could listen to Rick Ross all day and just listen to the big beats and the funny one-liners that he occasionally come up with, but then I can't listen to J. Cole because it's like depth and it's thought, and I've got to sit there and listen to him and watch him process what it felt like to hear his girlfriend tell him she was pregnant and have to contemplate whether it would be right for her to have an abortion. Like, these are things that not necessarily everybody can sit there and gribble with, or things that not everybody wants to necessarily listen to in their songs, because they're like, man, that's real life. I don't want to hear real life. I want to hear about like taking drugs kind of thing. So it's
escapism.
It very much is escapism. And that's, I suppose, why like people find it cool. Did you complete different segue here, but again, this is why people find it cool. For all the coolness and subjectiveness of like rap and hip hop, do you know who the highest selling albums have been, who have sold the most albums in the last three decades, each decade?
I mean, I assume Adele's got to be up there for this decade.
Sorry, for rap. Or for
hip-hop. Oh, for rap. Yeah. Kanye, Jay-Z?
Nope. I'll give you a clue. In every decade, they've all been white.
Oh, Eminem.
Yep. So far this decade.
Oh, Beastie Boys?
Yep. And so far this decade?
Oh, not Macklemore.
Macklemore?
No!
And in the 90s?
Ice?
Yes.
Oh, God.
So like,
I'm so ashamed for my culture.
So like, for all we sit there and say, for all the interesting commentary that come out from like rap music being glorified and rap music, like the people who sell the most albums, bruh.
Oh my God.
Telling different stories.
I mean, that's terrible. But something you said earlier just did interest me in terms of the future. And I think there's two things. There's one, you know, you're going to start seeing not just music, but movies as well coming out that were being made either during the election cycle or in a fully, you know, post-Trump presidency, which I think is interesting to see what now happens, because as terrible as Donald Trump is as a person, you know, adverse pressures can often cause great art in ways that are horrible for lots of people on the front line. But, you know, we move through it, and it's a great way for people to mediate what's happening in their day-to-day lives. Yeah. And also, when, like, are people going to phase out the interludes of family members talking on albums? Because it's not that I dislike them. I'm just amazed at how often they appear on albums in the last, like, 12 months. And is this, are we on the, has it reached maturity, or are we still got a ways to go with that yet?
The interesting thing about that is, like, how many times can you hear it, right? Like, as much as I loved it, and I loved hearing Stormzy's, like, mum, like, sit there and speak, like, it was a massive throwback to, like, my upbringing and my family and how my mum would sound, right? But if I play that album again and that interlude comes on, I'm clicking next. I hear it once.
Even in Blonde from last year, Frank Ocean's album, he's got, like, he's got one with his...
Be Yourself.
Be Yourself. Don't do that marijuana.
Stop trying to be somebody else. Don't try to be someone else. Be yourself and know that that's good
enough.
Don't
do that cocaine. But there's also the one, the Facebook story one, where it's some French dude on there talking about I don't know what. I'm just like, what are you doing, Frank? Like, I'm all here for you on the songs. Oh. And then you've just got these weird, like, I don't know what. I don't know what you call them, but I don't know. At points, you know what? There's lots of them on Solange's record as well.
I think Solange's one kind of works. It tells that story, and but again, like the same thing. After I've heard it the first time, I'm going to click next.
That's like,
I'm going to click next. I think what you, yeah. And thank goodness they've given us that option, right? Because they could have easily just, like, added it at the start of the song. And, yeah. And Don't Touch My Hair would have started with Master P. Be like, you know, and that's why I decided to call it No Limit Records. Because, you know, like, yeah, it's...
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad that it's not just me that's noticed this as being all present. But, yeah. No, I think that's a good place to wrap up part two. That was a really interesting conversation, and I think that I just want to say, man, Drake really just needs to go away. We've had too much Drake. We've reached peak Drake. I love Drake as much as the next person, but there's only so much of a good thing you can have, I think.
Before we go, like, what do you want? Do you just want him to go away, or do you want him to, like, just find a lane and stay in his lane? Because I appreciate he's trying to like reach as many things as he can, like, and see how he's like trying to diversify his bonds, right? And I remember when I first heard him, I was like, man, this guy's a great rapper. And then he got emotional. I was like, all right, cool, like, he's getting emotional, but get back to the rapping. Oh great, you're rapping again, like, you've got bars, you've got flow, and now, like, what are you doing?
I it's not for him to necessarily stay in a lane. It's just that, I don't know, oversaturation, like, just kind of drowning in Drake music. Like, Views, I think, was 22 songs long, and then More Views is 24 songs long. I know, you know, he'd be the first one to say, well, it's not an album, it's a playlist.
Did he call it More Views?
It's called More Views.
I thought it's called More Life, but I'm glad it's called More Views.
Oh, it might be called More Life. I'm sure it's called More Life. We'll have to fact check that one.
It may as well be called More Views.
Views on Views. Like, I think it's just, you know, as for me, if you're going to make an album, I really want to listen to it because I really like Drake, but it feels like my time was misused because lots of the songs feel part finished and there's some really good songs on there and he's got some really good features, but it really just feels like unfocused and without direction. And you know when you have an expectation of an artist and you know they can do so much more, you just want to be like, just go away and have some. I mean, how can you still be thinking of really good ideas if you've been touring and writing like songs for the last 2 years? You know, you need to give yourself a break, dude. Just go on holiday. Go to Jamaica and hang out with Riri and just, you know, have a great time.
All right. Yeah, let's end it there and start part three. But I grant you some of those. But would you also agree that some of the things that you have said haven't been true? I mean, you say that Ted Cruz's father was with Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, that was in a newspaper. No, I like Ted Cruz, he's a friend of mine. But that wasn't a newspaper. I didn't say that. I was referring to a newspaper. A Ted Cruz article referred it to a news story with had a picture of Ted Cruz, his father, and Lee Harvey Oswald having breakfast.
But traditionally, people in your position in the Oval Office have not said things unless they can verify they are true. Well, I'm not. Well, I think. I'm not saying. I'm quoting. Michael, I'm quoting highly respected people and sources from major television networks.
If you don't know, that was the President of the United States, Donald Trump. That was an interview he gave to Time magazine about lying in a very, very hilarious way. The website Jezebel did an excerpt of the interview where they blocked out all the lies said by Donald Trump. And in a couple of those pages, it's just blank. It's just like just complete blank, as if it was a CIA file where you twink over the lies or the bits that's like
been redacted.
It's literally just blank. It's just lines of like twink added out. And yeah, what did you think of just reading those just those two paragraphs?
It's so difficult. I mean, you can't help but laugh. I don't know what's going on inside there. I just wish he'd check his sources, you know? Like, I know, you know, he's probably not been to university, but it's just, you know, first year uni stuff.
He has his own university.
Yeah, probably has his own uni. Yeah, of course. How could I forget? But you're just like, you can't not. Don't you check these things? Like, just out of basic curiosity, you go and be like, I wonder if that's true. And then you maybe, like, Google it. Because, you know, these things are easy nowadays, Donald. You can just Google things and the answer will be there.
It's sensational reading. It's absolutely sensational reading. And the piece de resistance is the final line. I'm going to just read it really quickly before we finish off this episode of the podcast. The final line that he gives at the end of this interview is something that you would give as a school kid, all right? So I'll start off with one of... But I inherited a mess. I inherited a mess in so many ways. I inherited a mess in the Middle East and a mess with North Korea. I inherited a mess with jobs. The statistics, you know, my statistics are even better. But they are not the real statistics because you have millions of people that can't get a job, okay? And I inherited a mess on trade. I mean, we have many... You can go up and down the ladder. But that's the story. Hey, look, in the meantime, I guess I can't be doing so badly because I'm president and you're not. You know? Say hello to everybody for me, okay? Let me say that again. But that's the story. Hey, look, in the meantime, I guess I can't be doing so badly because I'm president and you're not.
I mean, he doesn't know the answer, though. He says, I guess. Like, you know, when you see it written down, he guesses. Like, he doesn't know. He's just little Donald J. Trump just looking for some... A fatherly approval, and he doesn't know. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know why he's there. He doesn't know if he wants to be there or not. All he knows is that he's the president and the president is winning America, therefore everybody else suck it.
Everybody else suck it. So yeah, basically, we again, why did we bring this up on a podcast about doing things with the culture? Two reasons. One, I wanted to just remind everybody that this is happening. Like, it isn't a joke. This isn't a joke. Like, this is actually happening. And two, I am an Nigerian, right? I'm a Nigerian. I grew up being told everywhere, Nigeria is corrupt, that our leaders are terrible, are stupid, are the reasons why we're being screwed over, right?
Can I just add as well, like, not just stupid, but, like, comical? And yeah, they're like, you know, we can all sit around and laugh at it because it's comical, but actually we wouldn't take it seriously because it's comical.
Because it's comical. Right. So like, no one takes Jacob Zuma seriously because we're just like, look, he's just an idiot. He doesn't represent the entire country. Like, he's just an idiot. And in a certain way, if Robert Mugabe had given out this interview, like, we'd be up in arms. Like, we'd sit there and point and be like, this is why Africa was turning into the toilet. We would make no mention of the amount of aid that is actually leaving Africa and going to Europe and how it doesn't compare to the amount of aid that is coming into Africa from Europe. But that's another topic for another day. But the point there is, this shit isn't normal. And if it was an African leader saying this shit, we'd lambast him and call it corrupt. But here it is, the president of the United States, yep, saying, hey, I can't be doing so bad because, hey, I'm president.
And I think, I don't know if you're laughing just because if you don't laugh, you'll cry about these things.
Cry.
But the tone of it, if it wasn't the American president, would be, look at this foreign country. They don't deserve democracy. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know what's good for themselves. Maybe we might invade them. Like, all of these things.
Let's go give them democracy. Let's go give them.
They don't. They're not. They can't be trusted with nice things. And, you know, it's just total tragicomedy that these things are happening in America and there's seemingly nothing that people can do about it. Although, yeah, let's just not even get into it. It's comical, but I agree that it should be taken with more seriousness, that the president can sit there and basically be like, nah, 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 to the press.
All right, look, that'll be the end of Distorted Shades of Grey. How do you think it went?
Yeah, I thought it went good. First episode. Didn't make any terrible mistakes. Well, we'll have to wait back actually and see that on second listen. But no, it was great fun. Thanks very much for hosting this week. I'll be hosting next week. And I look forward to hearing the finished article.
Yeah, no worries. Where can we find this, by the way?
So our website is in production. This podcast will be hosted on the website. But I suppose we'll publish this later in the week, so we will next week we'll have the website details.
But yeah, thank you all for listening. We'll be doing this once a week.
Sweet.
Peace. What music are we going to use to our outro?
I feel like, I mean, we could change it every week, but it feels right that this week it's the Wire theme tune.
All right, we'll do it. There it is. Thank you very much for listening. Remember, get out there and do it for the culture.
See you guys.
When you walk through the garden, you gotta watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon. Walk the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he's gonna save your soul. Gotta keep the devil